You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Keith Donahue is the author of The Stolen Child, Angels of Destruction, Centuries of June, The Boy Who Drew Monsters, and The Motion of Puppets. His new novel is The Girl in the Bog. Thank you for joining me, Keith.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
This is a remarkable novel, and I think different from at least much of your oeuvre. This book employs the yin for horrors, yang, humor, and horror. What made you take up that particular tack with this particular book?
Well, I love humor, and Centuries of June is the other funny book that I've written. But for The Girl in the Bog, I was determined to try again to make people laugh. And the real inspiration for it was the Toyne, the cattle raid on Cooley, and the Irish myth, which if you dip your toe into, you'll find yourself sucked underwater. It's body, violent, concerned with how people talk, and irresistible in the end. So I thought, well, what could be funnier than to write a spoof about a legend that nobody knows outside of Ireland?
It was really funny. And what you alluded to, Irish myth, brings up one thing that I thought that this book is very consistent with all your other books, in that you like to employ myth. And what I think is really interesting is you suggested, and not without reason, that most people would not know the myths that this book was based on. And I was thinking about your previous book, The Motion of Puppets, which is Orpheus and Eurydice. Again, not the most well-known of myths. And I think one of the powers of all the myths that underlie all of your books is this idea of the Jungian unconscious, which is to say that when you start speak to these myths, even if we don't know them specifically, they are always bubbling up in our brains. Talk about, using the collective unconscious to help shape your writing.
That's a great question. The impulse behind this was the Irishness of it. And that's my ancestry, Irish, although I'm American by nature, I suppose. But there's also that sort of creeping sensation of when I'm ever reading Irish books, or I'm around Irish people, or I'm listening to Irish music or what have you, that I've heard this before somewhere, that there's some deep connection that I feel. And it's not sentimental at all. It's really based on a couple of things. One is certain phrases and expressions and modes of being I've inherited from my own father. And I'm sure it goes back generations, where there's a way of looking at the world through slightly absurd lenses that I think derives from what you're describing, this sort of collective unconscious. In the case of Ireland, that's a tough history those people had with invasion and incursion and famine and, just the everyday toughness of life in a wet climate, wet, cold climate, I think helps shape a consensus or consensual way of looking at the world. And certainly in the case of Ireland, you know, there's this rich pagan history, prehistory. And then there's this whole Catholic period, and now we're into something else. And I think that that has something to do with it as well. So with that feeling in mind, more than anything else, that's when I decided to try my hand in an Irish story.
You know, it interested me too, the inspirations of this book, because they seem so, like, incredibly vast. This book combines opposites that you think one would think might not be combinable. On one hand, there are the literary inspirations, and I think this is true of much writing, and in particular the horror genre, and not this is more I would call this the supernatural genre.
Mm-hmm.
In that, at this point in 2024, you can borrow from two different vats, as it were. Yeah. On one hand, there's the whole literary background, and this really has some heavy James Joyce humor in it. And it also has, you know, the literary background of Arthur Mach and some of the other old masters who dealt in the fairy world. But also, and you can borrow from, you know, the filmic traditions as well. And I think, you know, this is, I think, the only book that I think can be said, I've ever read, that can be said to successfully combine James Joyce and He-Man and the Masters of the Universe quite successfully. Talk about mining those two traditions, you know, the horror and humor film genre and the supernatural and the literary genre of Joyce, the Blarney genre.
Boy, you packed a lot into that question, right? So, yeah, of course, I'm a creature of the modern age and love film. I'm not sure that I ever saw He-Man, but I get it. The He-Man that I'm, you know, the Women Haters He-Man Club is what I, from the Little Rascals, is what I most know. Yeah, so there are a chain of literary references in there. You mentioned James Joyce, but also Flann O'Brien to a large degree. And the bog poetry of Seamus Heaney, who I studied as a lad in the, you know, late 70s. So there's all that. And there's, you know, I love those stories. I ruthlessly steal from those stories whenever I can. The counterpoint, of course, to all that is film or dramatic literature, where you've got this sort of two figures, the Laurel and Hardy, or the two clowns from Godot, or what have you, that are sort of aimlessly wandering the universe of their minds, and quite willing to talk about anything and everything. So it's, and I think I imagine these things cinematically, which is not to say I'm thinking of writing a movie where I want it to move like a movie, but I see it that way. I see these, you know, situations and characters. So the He-Man in this book is Cuchulainn, right? And, you know, he's like the great hero of Irish myth. He can take on a whole army of thousands of warriors and lick them all. And, you know, but by the same token, I'm enough of a fan of the movies to know that that guy, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of guy, is, you know, can often be kind of a dope, that, you know, he's not entirely self-aware of who he is. And that's perhaps what you need to be in order to, you know, win a war single-handedly. So it's that, yeah, it's that exaggeration that the horror genre and movies and of our, in that case, of our fears, but in this case of our sort of comic book admiration of, you know, Superman and so forth, that they always struck me as a little bit dull. You know, those guys, they were great at saving the universe, not so great at interpersonal communication. So
you mentioned comic book just now, and that was one of the things I think this book successfully captures, and it's really hard to capture in words, is the feel of a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Yeah.
There was a series by Cage Baker, and she did a whole book based around Looney Tunes cartoons as incarnated in the Indian figure of the coyote.
How about that? I want to look that up.
And I think this book does a similar thing for, you know, like the Elmer Fuddish characters. Mm-hmm. But let's kind of talk a bit about the plot. It begins when an Irish farmer named Mulaney digs up a bog body. And you did a bit of research on bog bodies, and we learned a lot about them. Tell us about the bog people.
The bog people. Well, of course, you know, Ireland's a wet, cold place, like much of Northern Europe, and the creation of these standing bodies of water and vegetation, particularly sphagnum moss and other things, grow at the edges and sort of encroach upon the middle, upon what Heaney calls the wet center of Ireland. They sort of, and as the vegetation decays, it, you know, naturally sinks to the bottom eventually, and over time the bogs become more and more filled with stuff, including, should one happen to accidentally or on purpose fall into one, people. People were sometimes placed in bogs after they died or after they were killed or sacrificed or what have you. The most famous one that I know of is the Toland man, who came up with a noose around his neck. Now, the chemicals in the bog tan the skin, they darken it. And of course the bones are another story altogether, and they turn the hair red, of all things. And so imagine your astonishment. You're digging for some turf bricks for your fire to dry out for over the summer for your fire, and you come across a hand or a foot, and you wonder, how old is that? Because this process can take thousands of years, or it could take, you know, months. And so the Mulaney, the farmer, feels an attachment to this figure that he's dug up. And to keep her out of prying eyes, he rolls her up in a tarp and takes her home and puts her in his shed. So, it's a fascinating natural phenomenon. There's hundreds of these bodies, and some of them are in museums and so forth. So there's plenty of history, archaeological history, with, of course, the attendant speculative questions about how did they die? Why did they die? That particular body in the bog. But all organic, butter. They used to bury butter in the bogs, and they can now come out with, you know, a chunk of 2,000-year-old butter.
Now, Mulaney has a good friend, Burke. You were just talking about Waiting for Godot. Right. And the conversations these two guys have are absolutely hilarious. And I can tell one thing that, as readers, it's pretty easy to tell when the author's having fun. And you will have fun as the reader as well. And you were having a blast writing Burke, and especially writing the conversations between these two.
Right. So Burke is the blatherer. He's the one who'll say anything. He does have a degree of self-awareness, and he loves himself, perhaps more than anyone else. And he will, he's the funny man to Mulaney's straight man, essentially, where Mulaney's kind of often in disbelief about what his friend doesn't know or what he decides to do in dangerous situations. He won't stop talking. So when he should be quiet.
Now, I think that this book, I had an experience in this book that I thought was just really quite enjoyable, which is in about a paragraph and a half. You just go from a horrifyingly a dangerous and violent situation to a laugh out loud situation. I laughed more when I read this book than in many a book. And I think that's one of the aspects of horror that comes out more often in film than it does in the written genre. So talk about a book that's filled with jokes, puns. I love puns. My wife just rolls her eyes and says, I'll just show her something, and she just says, oh my God, what's the matter with you?
Yeah, well, I let myself go. I mean, all my dad jokes are in there. And it's a very punny culture. I mean, they love to talk, and they love the sound of words and the meaning and their double meaning. And that's actually, I don't know, I don't really speak a lot of Irish. I mean, I know the basics, but that's actually as true in Irish as it is in the Irish language, as it is in the English language, where words, you know, one word can mean 40 different things, depending on the context. And that's the sign of a culture that loves the pun. I was thinking of earlier in your question about laughing. And one of my great laughs in a horror movie, and I think it's in Alien or Aliens or whatever, I can never get them right, is when the cat appears. I was like, oh man, that's hilarious, because it's just build up, bam, it's a cat. Oh jeez, that release, right, of from in comedy is what we're looking for.
It actually has a name in the genre, the spring-loaded cat.
There you go, spring-loaded cat.
Done well in a movie, in the movie version of Reanimator, which in retrospect this reminds me of, which is also a combination of over the top humor and over the top horror. One of the things I think you do really well is to create these characters, and the character of Fedelum, is that right?
Fedelum.
You really both have fun, and I think stretch the horror genre or the supernatural genre, shall we say, with your creation of this character who begins the storyline underneath the bog.
And narrating, right?
Which is fun, but also, a fascinating use of the trope of the fantastic.
Yeah. And I'll tell you the secret, right? I had to figure out a way to get her to understand and be able to speak English.
There you go. I was because I thought you did a good job of, in Well, I think that's true for this book in general. By virtue of choosing the setting you have and the characters you have and the backdrop you have, you allow yourself to invent the rules. It's not like a vampire novel where, okay, we know they're going to have sharp teeth, drink blood, come out at night. Right. I mean, you can toss all that stuff away and make it up yourself as you go.
Yeah, that and so I had you. I mean, in creating those rules, right? You either just sort of try to sneak them in, or you just be blatant about, I'm building this here, and I'm going to take 10 pages or whatever it is to tell you her backstory that you don't necessarily. I mean, I suppose I could have just pretended that she spoke English. And allowed her to do so. But Fidelum, of course, is from the cattle raid on Cooley. And when I was reading the Toyn, the cattle raid, she's just this minor figure in the story, in the overall story. She's maybe, you know, 5 pages out of 800 or whatever. She's comes along and exits the scene, but she had this tremendous appeal for me because she stands up to the queen of the West, who asked her, you know, basically, let me know how I'm gonna win this war. And Fidelum says, well, you're not. This one guy, Cathalan, is gonna turn Ireland crimson and red with the blood of your soldiers. And I just thought, Fidelum, you don't say that to the queen. So I had my character, the girl in the bog, as it is, you know, right from the start. And that was the great thing for me. It was the great thing of marrying this old myth, this great myth, and this situation where a bog body suddenly pops up, and oh, what if it's the same person, you know, and I was off.
Now, another modern mythology I think that informs us, or at least informs our experience with the book, is Buffy.
Buffy, right.
And for you, Buffy are the three hags, as they call themselves. These are three girls are born in very much a John Wyndhamish fashion. Who can forget the wonderful story of the Midwich Cuckoos?
I don't know it.
Oh, okay. Well, in that book, it's a story by him. It's science fiction. And all the women in a village turn up pregnant on the same day, on the same time. They all give birth at the same time. All the children are very strange and very similar, and maybe they're not entirely human. Here we have three girls born at the same time. They're pretty strange. Their hair is very red.
Yes. Their hair is very red, and as a redhead myself, you know, I can understand that, how strange that must seem to other people, to have red hair.
This is a very ginger novel.
A very ginger novel, yeah. And, you know, the Macbeth witches and so forth, the weird sisters, the all kinds of tropes there going on. But I needed somebody to help Fidelum along in her journey. And then, of course, their sort of subplot, if you will, gets full throttle. And they just become more interesting to me the more, you know, the more things they do to get Fidelum out of harm's way, they become more and more interesting to me. And then, you know, one of my favorite parts of the book is when Fidelum leaps into each one's mind and gets a taste of what these three redheaded teenagers are thinking about. It was fun. And that's what I wanted the whole book to be. It's fun.
It really is. And I love all the scenes with Kukulin are such a joy to me, because there's one scene, it's, you really have fun with this book on a number of levels, just on, you know, various on language. There's a scene where Burke and Melania are trying to dig up the body, which Melania has hidden, and they're standing by the light of his heroic.
Yeah. Right. They're at night and they're digging holes in the bog, you know, with no purpose, because Melania's hidden the body in the shed. And they're out there still digging away, pretending this, you know, because they're under threat to produce this body. And I thought, well, boy, it would be dark out there. But no, they don't need a. They'll just stand in his glow.
Now, one of the things I think that's interesting about all your books is that you plot on two levels. There's what happens to the characters and what the people are doing. But another kind of plotting that I think you do really well, which is the plotting of revealing what the whole supernatural tropes are and how that all works out. Talk about that, intertwining those two kind of pacings, which in this book is just absolutely superbly well done.
How about that? Well, yeah, so we may have talked about this before, but I start, you know, I have an idea, let's call it an idea, you know, a bog body and the cattle raid on Cooley somehow get all mixed up. And then I think, okay, well, how do you structure such a thing and carry out the, you know, task of the novel, which is to, you know, lead you in a suspenseful way to the ending. And I had three sets of characters. I mean, this is an ensemble book. There's not really a, you know, protagonist per se or antagonist per se. It's like there's three groups. There's Cahullin and his group. There's Queen Maeve, who is his opponent. And then there's the girl from the bog in the bog. So I had these three things, three spirals, like a interconnected, you know, symbol on that's carved into a stone at Newgrange, 2,000 years old, this threeness. And of course, that's like such an Irish thing, associated with such an Irish thing, because, you know, then you've got Patrick with his shamrock, and, you know, so three becomes this mystical number. The trick, I think, for me, was trying to balance that out and show, okay, here's what's happening over here in one story A, here's what's happening in B and C, and maybe they are running concurrently, maybe they're not, maybe you, the reader, learn some things in one chapter, and then, oh, there's more in the next, and that was the sort of the fun of it for me is, there are other characters that get introduced that are not from myth, but from folklore. And once I had them sort of intersect with one of the main stories, then I knew I could drop them into the other two stories. Or I could, you know, take a character and have her show up in two different places. And the reader knows who that is, but the other characters have no idea. So I think that's the way for me of like interlacing these elements.
It's the old trick of the seven samurai.
Exactly. Where, you know, and there's a great book about that. The Last Samurai, Helen DeWitt. Do you know the book?
No.
Yeah, it's a novel, like a contemporary take on that story. And the little boy who's searching for his father is a genius. I mean, just a genius. And it's so well done. So well done.
One of the things I think that's interesting about this book is it has a more episodic feel than your other books. When I think of The Boy Who Drew Monsters, it's just like, you know, a motorcycle ride down one long, terrifying path till you plunge out over the abyss.
Right.
Talk about, for you as a writer, do you like to just change things up for yourself just to entertain yourself, or does the material itself dictate the style of storytelling?
Well, in this case, because it's it spoofs in a way The Cattle Raid on Cooley, I had that to contend with, plot, if you will. And it's a very simple thing. And yet, there's so many digressions. There's so many stories within the story. One of the things that readers, I hope, learn from, if they haven't read the original, is this fascinating story of Cahalan, who is this great warrior. So the book, the epic, begins in the present day. War is about to begin, and then you have a 40-page digression about the boyhood exploits of Cahalan, and to tell you the whole story of how he came to be the great Irish hero, and so I found that was something I couldn't not do. But then I had to put my spin on it and try to make it funnier than it is in the original story. And I had this Cahalan sidekick, Loig.
Loig and Burke, when they get into it, man, it's a joy.
Yeah. So Loig is this other fellow who was like going to tell you the story. And then I did have so much fun with Loig in terms of, how would you explain all this to a contemporary audience? How would, to a modern day pair of farmers, how would you tell the story? And of course, you would use language that they would understand. So Cahalan loves to go to conferences because he likes the swag. And he, he starts drinking and you can't stop him. And don't give him a pipe. Don't teach him how to smoke, because I'll be up buying fags at the store, night and day. So Loig is like his caretaker. And he's got one wary eye on his charge.
And this is a novel where it just struck me that where story itself, narrative itself, is part of the plot, not just in that it tells the plot, but the sub-narratives that the stories within the stories take up, they are actual parts of the plot. And I think that's an interesting and really fun and very literary technique. And what's really fun is to see this very literary technique used to create laugh out loud experiences for the reader.
Yeah, and I mean, to go back to your earlier question, it is self-indulgent in a way to say, okay, well, let's introduce the figure of the banshee into this story. And what would she be doing in modern day Ireland? She's not wandering the countryside like she used to, or they used to. And so I have her discovered at home, not her home, but a home she's taken up, and she's entertaining herself by watching old black and white movies on the TV, including Red River, which is the John Wayne movie about a cattle drive, which is, you know, the cattle raid on Cooley is the same. So it's that, it's those moments where you just can't help you. It's like Donald using a pun, you can't help yourself. What would she be doing? Yeah, that's what she would be doing.
Since you referred to this Irish myth, let's rush back and give us some idea. How did you first come upon this? Was it this just the result of random research, or was this a book you found in your dad's library?
No, my dad's library. So in Flann O'Brien's At Swim Two Birds, one of the characters, and it's similar in a lot of ways, but I don't want to claim too much here, but is Finn McCool, which is who's the other great Irish figure from the Iron Age. And I always thought, boy, that's such so much fun and so funny. And did Flann O'Brien ever write another book like that? No, he didn't. So there was no book about Cathalan. There was no comedy about Cathalan. So I thought, okay, well, what do I know? Very little. His story is in the cattle raid in Cooley and other places, but mostly there. And so I sat down and read it. I sat down and read it's this long poem with stretches of prose and you know, like and it's for a modern person. You know, it's got like lists of names of the warrior that I'm going to name. And they go as like 5 pages of, there were 6, you know, Connors and 7 Cardinals. And you know, it's like, okay, so how can I take sort of what can I make the best use out of in those stories? So, yeah, all those great picturesque moments are... You don't have to read the time, the cattle raid on Cooley. It's in there. It's not. So in a way, it was like, well, that part's easy in a sense of when you're writing a spoof, is just follow the spoof, follow the original, and you've got some structure. But I rapidly became convinced that I just couldn't. Why bother retelling a myth unless you're trying to do something else? And one of the things I was trying to do was have fun. In the cattle raid opens up more or less with a chapter that the modern translators call pillow talk. And Queen Maeve and Aviel, her husband, her second or third husband, I can't remember what, are in bed talking. And he says to her, boy, aren't you lucky to have married me? I'm rich and I've got all this stuff. And she says, you know, I was doing fine by myself. You know, I've got things too. I've got riches and da-da. And he says, well, the one thing you don't have, after the long list of things, the one thing you don't have is the best bull in Ireland. I've got the best bull in Ireland. And she says, well, I know of a better one, and I'm going to go ask them if I can borrow it, the people of Ulster. And they say no. So she says, well, I'll just go take it. And who can't love somebody like that? Maeve. So I had Maeve and Al, and to introduce them to the reader, I have them in bed together. And somebody knocks on the door, and they come to the door, and I decided instead of like this antique, you know, ancient version, that they would be more like a screwball couple, like you know, the Thin Man or something like that, where they're kind of jokey, flirty. They have this sort of competitive nature, and that's how I got them into the book and made them my own.
We have yet to speak of Bridget, who is our, you know, the modern American character in all this. Talk about, she was the kind of, my thought, at least in a sense, of the Buffy inspiration. So talk about bringing in the midst of, you know, Ireland, and which is this, you know, it's a very distinct climate and country, bringing in, you know, your vast land of America.
Yeah, well, so you, at some point in the whole process, somebody, agent or editor, mentioned to me something about, you know, you need a better, more Bridget in this. And I'm like, what, why? And they said, well, for an American audience, we need a proxy. And I thought, oh, well, that's very clever, you know. And so I thought, okay, well, why would an American archaeologist be in Ireland? And what's she like? So I thought, well, she's Irish American. She's got all sort of all the sentimentality and half knowledge of, you know, the Irish towards the Irish Americans towards Ireland. Yet she's a dedicated student of the morbid. You know, that's her background. She is one of those weird little kids who love to pretend they're dead, or, you know, bury their dolls, or, you know, that sort of thing. A long time ago, I had come across the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, which is this sort of 19th century-ish house of horrors of, you know, the human body and anatomy and so forth. And I just thought, okay, well, that she'd love that place. And I had a character in mind. So she's Philadelphia. Then there's a famous play called Philadelphia, Here I Come, which is about an Irishman emigrating to America. So I just flipped it and put this Philadelphia woman off to Ireland, the old sod, where she's rapidly disabused of her notions, including her Irish grandfather's, you know, tall tales.
One of the things I think is so interesting about Ireland's setting is how distinct the climate is and how huge an impact it has had on the culture of Ireland. In a sense, everything, all Irish art is a reflection of a big damp bog.
It's about the rain. You know, it's still raining. It'll rain again. You know, the great 40 Shades of Green. Is that right? Of Ireland is because it's so wet there. And yeah, that's a recurring theme. And you know, the bog girl is a wet girl. She comes out of the soil, and hence she has a problem when she's not in the bog. So that was something that occurred to me actually pretty late in the game, that, you know, how they, when they find these bog bodies, they immediately put them in a climate controlled box or, you know, case or whatever, because once out of the bog, you harden. You dry and harden.
Talk about, you know, the basis of the novel, the story of the Battle of the Bull, as an ending. And I think one of the things that you do so well is your endings are always kind of shoot the reader out into the void, and you just, it's like, you know, at the very end, you climb into the rocket.
Yeah.
And so talk about, you know, the power of the ending of your source and your own inclinations towards an ending, because in the Motion of Puppets as well, that's a novel that has an absolutely beautiful ending, and this does as well. Talk about, you know, the creating that. What is it about the ending of a novel that seems to, like, shoot you full of inspiration?
Yeah, well, I mean, you work so hard to get there, for one thing. You know, otherwise you'd have a poem or something. In this case, you know, the reader does not know who and why these people were after the girl in the bog. Cahalan on the one side and Maeve on the other. We don't really know precisely who's the bad guy and who's the good guy in this war. Same thing for the book. Same thing for the cattle ran on Cooley. I mean, you can say, well, Maeve shouldn't go steal the bull. But on the other hand, they should have lent it to her. So I have these two adversaries, and I knew that in some way I had to bring them together and resolve this situation. And, you know, because it's a supernatural book, if you want, or a dream book, if you want, you know, it's tied into that day. It's tied into how a day moves. And I had heard an expression somewhere along the way about the blue hour, that the hour between night and day. And, you know, that struck me as such a magical concept that I knew I was moving towards the blue hour. And, you know, that situation, the big myth situation resolves itself in the blue hour, but then I've got these characters who are not part of the blue hour. They're, you know, real, for want of a better word. And, you know, we're left with the Millennium Burke and the witches and Bridget and the Bog Girl. And I knew then what was going to happen. I knew as soon as I tied up that one scene, I knew that this coda, so to speak, had to happen. Because this is in the Irish tradition of murder. And you know, not to give anything away, but there's a famous play, The Playboy of the Western World, which takes the opposite example of, you know, this lad who commits a crime against his father, and then it makes this whole play work. Well, I knew I had to have something similar happen where, you know, somebody has to act in order to change the history of this thing. And I hope it's a surprise.
You know, one of the surprises we get whenever we open a Keith Donahue book is what it's about.
Yeah.
In that, you know, we could be on the Stolen Child, you know, book 8 or 9 right now. And I'm sure it would be, you know, wonderful. What makes you, you know, toss every world create to the side to make a new one?
Well, foolhardiness, I suppose. you know, I might be retired by now if I had taken your advice and written 8 sequels. And it's not that I haven't thought. Okay, I do think about it. I'm actually thinking about it right now, not this moment, but recently, about what happened to Spec and that story. As a way of writing my next book. I mean, there's one sort of in the can, but the one after that. And I don't know. I mean, it's tough for me because I take that idea of the novel as making something new. I take that quite seriously. So it would have to be enough of a substantive excursion for me. I don't want to use big words here, but sort of as an artist, it's like, you can paint the same garden over and over and over and over until you, you know, or you can change it up. You can, so it's as basic as that, really. It's not that I don't believe in these things as they're being written, because I do. I mean, I have an intent with, you know, the Gothic, or I've written, this is now my second book that I was intending to be funny. I mean, it was my primary palette. Whereas some of the others were, because I love these other traditions, you know, I wanted to test myself to see if I could write a Gothic or write, you know, or in some cases it's about structure. It's like, can I write a back and forth novel, you know, two narrators? Can I write a, you know, a book that's structured around this long flashback, you know, that's a third in law, third of the book. So it's these kind of weird artistic questions. Like, why do I do this? It was sort of like George Harrison. Why did he pick up the, you know, sitar? And all of a sudden, is, well, you're off. I mean, he didn't need to do it. He could have, you know, whatever. It's because I think one gets interested in the tools of the trade and the methods and the modes, and more so than, you know, oh, can I write another hit? I think that's for me, it's a fool's game. Because I can't plan these things out. To, like, market research says, I don't care. So.
The new book by Keith Donahue is The Girl in the Bog. Thank you for joining me, Keith.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.